Hi, this is Alan Chartok, delighted to be in conversation today with Alyssa Quart, author, multimedia narrative journalist, and this year's James H. Ottaway Sr. Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz, the only endowed professorship named for the founder of Ottaway Newspapers Incorporated, now the Dow Jones Local Media Group. Professor Quart is the author of three critically acclaimed nonfiction books, Republic of Outsiders, The Power of Amateurs, Dreamers and Rebels, Branded, The Buying and Selling of Teenagers, and Hothouse Kids, The Dilemma of the Gifted Child. Her books have been published in 14 languages. Professor Quart is currently co-editor of Economic Hardship Reporting Project with Barbara Ehrenreich, a nonprofit devoted to developing and supporting journalism about inequality. Her current multimedia project, The End of the Middle, is about America's struggling middle class and is supported by the Magnum Foundation. Her first book of poetry, Monetized, is out and is being reviewed well. Professor Quart has also written for the New York Times, Sunday Review, The Atlantic, The Times Magazine, Elle, The Nation, London Review of Books, and many other publications. In addition, she served as contributing writer-editor at Columbia Journalism Review. She's also written for the New York Times, Sunday Review, The Atlantic, The Times Magazine, Elle, The Nation, London Review of Books, and many other publications. In addition, she served as contributing writer-editor at Columbia Journalism Review and Mother Jones, and formerly a senior editor of the multimedia ebook publisher The Atavist. The transmedia work she co-conceived, wrote, and produced for The Atavist, The Last Clinic, was nominated for an Emmy and a National Magazine Award in 2014. Professor Quart previously taught at the Columbia University School of Journalism and was a 2010 Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. As the Ottaway Professor at New Paltz, Quart is teaching an upper-level journalism seminar called Narrative Nonfiction in the Digital Age. Well, welcome, Alyssa Quart.
Thank you, Alan.
Well, so this is very exciting. You know how I love New Paltz and taught there for most of my adult life and think that it's one of the great institutions. I think you're going to love it in your work there. So they're lucky to have you. I mean, your resume is quite impressive. How did you do all that?
You know, I don't know, sort of controlled mania. The poetry book I've been working on off and on for many years, so it just sort of emerged this year finally. So that was a process. But the other stuff, I don't know. I think it's partially having a kid, and I started to use my time with more clarity and intensity.
So I've been reading your father's stuff in the Berkshire Eagle for a million years, and he probably reading mine for the same million years. So the question I have is, did you come by this naturally, this journalism thing?
Yeah, I mean, I was initially a critic, much in the kind of pattern of my family, my dad and my mom, who were both film critics. But the reported piece, the reported essay, multimedia, all this stuff was definitely a new direction. You know, I started in maybe 20 years ago.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Village. We have an apartment. My parents have been there since 68.
Yeah. So what did you learn in the Village?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, my new poetry book, Monetized, is really a portrait of the East Village in that period, from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I was born in the early, mid-70s. And then it also follows what happens to New York and its gentrification, what I call its monetization, and what happens to journalism. So it's a poetry book about the East Village, but also about the end of legacy media. So it's sort of, I think that's part of why people have been kind of interested in it, because it's a poetry book about journalism.
Alyssa, what did happen to journalism?
You know, I wrote a lot about this for CJR in the last decade, I guess. Well, we know what happened. I mean, there was decoupling of, you know, the middleman that used to kind of control content, and the gatekeepers started to be removed from the premises by technology. We had corporations concentrating content. A lot of things happened. You know, there was also this kind of golden age in publishing that just became unsustainable as book sales, you know, plummeted. and people started buying ebooks that were much cheaper than paper books. So, I mean, there's so many different factors, and I was trying to sort of capture what it felt like to be a journalist and a writer during that downturn and during that kind of dissembling of these institutions that I really loved and trusted.
Do you think I made a mistake? The Berkshire Eagle called me up, and they said, you know, that they were having economic hard times. And they said, could you take a little less money than you're getting right now? I said, no, take it all. So I write for free now. Is that a mistake? Is that a betrayal of everybody else who relies on this for their money?
Well, I personally think that there is a lot of exploitation out there of writers, and it's understandable. I'm sure the Berkshire Eagle is under siege and is trying to stay afloat, but it's also, I feel like it's falling on a lot of the makers and the producers to do these labors of love rather than for us to try to find new models for sustainability, or as the Economic Hardship Reporting Project is trying to do, you know, raise nonprofit funding to support this work. That I think that is going to have to be the model for production more and more. I mean, you see so many journalism nonprofits, and there's no illusion for why this is happening. It's because, you know, the actual business isn't functioning.
Are we going to see any newspapers in 10 years?
People love to say these splashy things like it's the end of the newspaper. Are you talking about digital copies, or are you talking about
talking about hold the paper in your hand.
I see. I think they'll probably be like the New York Times. Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm wrong.
No,
I sometimes
right.
think it's going to be like an LP, you know, like some generation Z to the 10th will be, oh, I have a newspaper. Have you seen my newspaper collection? You know, it's going to be kind of like a object with an aura to it, the way that old media of different genres has that element now. The newspaper hasn't quite gotten to that sort of cult status, but I think one day it will.
I just went out and bought myself a long playing record player. And now I have all of these records that I...
See, you're just like the kids out in Williamsburg, or just like my students at New Paltz. They're fascinated by new technology and old technology, but in a kind of ironic, nostalgic way.
I don't know. I think, you know, you get a little bit more imperfections, but I think the sound is better. But I digress. The important point here is, and I think you're brilliant in your analysis, what's going to happen is it's going to go away. Most newspapers are going to fail. You'll see a lot of digital stuff, but you won't see a lot of on paper. And then somebody will rediscover it, just like with the LPs, and start putting out stuff on paper again.
Yeah, and there'll even probably be some kind of, I mean, there's already a zine collection at, you know, in NYU. There's a Fales library collection for zines and for broadsheets, you know, from the 70s through the 90s. I think, who knows, it could be still collecting. But I could just imagine there'll be like a, you know, newspaper font, you know, oh God, their paper stock was so cool back then, you know, who knows.
There's an article in a paper that says that kids born around now, how old is your child?
She's 4 years old.
Okay, kids born around now may live to 200 years old. So they have a lot.
Wait, which papers is
I don't remember where I saw it, but it's online this morning, a major study because of the genetic possibilities that our kids will live till 200. And that's long. And they'll be able to go through a lot of stuff. I wonder what the implications for journalism will be. That's a hard question, I know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was always fascinated. My own grandparents, my grandmother lived to 105.
Wow.
And the fact that she'd gone through all these different wars. And I feel like one thing that's interesting when you're close to people who've lived that long is that you feel this kind of intimacy with different periods of history that there's no way you could know. But, you know, I kind of can imagine what it was like to live in World War One just because I was so close to my grandparents, or what it was like to live during the Depression and be putting feathers on hats when you're 16 years old in a sweatshop. You know, I feel like there's certain kinds of leaps of imagination that you can come to through knowing people who've lived that long. So, I mean, it could sort of expand people's sensibilities all around.
That's really interesting. You know, I'm old. I'm 74. I'm going to be 74. And I remember World War II. And I remember when it was over. What was I, 4 years old? And I remember asking my mother, what was all the noise outside the apartment on the West Side going on? She said a terrible person named Hitler had been defeated. And I thought that was interesting. And so therefore, when I say to my students, I remember World War II, they look at me in utter disbelief.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure my students have, over the years, have probably hit it well when I go on about, you know, the 80s New York City and, you know, the disrepair, the beautiful disrepair of the city in that period. They're like, oh, yeah, whatever. But they're trying to look like they don't think I'm ancient.
Yeah, well, you're not, but I am. So my question then is, what is this narrative that you work in right now? What do you do?
I'm doing all this different stuff, which is kind of something that a lot of journalists have to do now, you know, work in multiple forms because the usual straight ahead newspaper jobs are, there are fewer of them, but it's also, you know, we live in this amazing moment. It's this moment of great possibility. So to get the best of it rather than just say, oh, man, you know, there's just no appetite for conventional long form narrative. You're like, okay, well, what can I do with a long form narrative to make it exciting for people interested in visual culture?
So what is a long form narrative?
Well, what we were doing at the Atavist was 8,000 to 12,000 words. But, you know, what we're doing with an Economic Hardship Reporting Project is shorter. It's sort of what online audiences can be attracted to or metabolize. So it's like, you know, 2,000 to 4,000 word stories, let's say. And they're about social justice themes, but I'm trying to think, you know, can I get somebody to shoot photography for this or do video or, you know, do infographics? How do I make a social justice narrative journalism work into something that, you know, yeah, like a 22-year-old will want to read on their phone? So that's sort of the challenge, I feel, as both a writer and a sort of editor, producer that I'm facing right now.
Now, your students are going to be sitting in that class. I teach a Legislative Gazette seminar once a week. And my students want to be journalists. And I gently probe with them, you know, whether there'll be jobs and job opportunities. So how much do you owe them in terms of telling them what to expect out there?
You know, I've been sort of telling them some stuff, like how, yeah, they've been given the brass tacks of a feature structure that's, you know, impartial and unbiased and just like a traditional feature article. And I'm like, well, look at the articles that people really are reading now. They have voices that are totally over the top often and are emphatic and take a position. And I'm not saying this is better or worse, but that is kind of what the marketplace seems to be most interested in, you know, is this kind of highly emphatic kind of writing. I mean, even if you're not saying I believe this or that, it's just more intense kind of writing style than you might have had in, say, the Times, right? So do we like this? Let's think about it. Or people who sort of do undercover sort of stunt journalism where they'll go and, you know, it's often investigative reporting too, where they'll go and pretend to be X or Y. And that is another way to get readers involved. It always was. It still is. You know, what's the ethics and morality around that, right? So these are the kind of questions I'm asking them. But also, how do we think about slideshows? You know, how do we think about taking photos while we're writing just so we have visual elements for a piece that we'd be pitching? So I guess that's how I'm trying to prepare them. You know, and I'm not trying to sugarcoat it and say, oh, yeah, there's lots of jobs. But I'm just trying to say there are different ways to know what you're doing. I mean, you know, also you can teach English, you can work for NGOs, and then also do journalism on the side. I try to explain about how nonprofits are now making it more possible for people to be supported doing serious work. And the stigma, I think, is starting to fade around getting funding from a human rights organization, let's say, to go shoot an assignment. That would, you know, in the past, that would have been seen as sort of maybe breaking a line editorially, but now it's more common. And so, like, as potential, you know, future journalists, like, what could they imagine that just isn't the typical line? Because the typical lines probably don't exist.
So, Alyssa Quart, do you ever look at a student and say, in your head, you know, you haven't got any chance at all. You're not smart enough. You won't make it. You know, find something to fall back on. Do you ever actually level with them, or can you, or is it ethical?
I don't. I mean, occasionally I've told people that they need to be more professional, and that's just the truth. You know, sloppy grammar is going to get you thrown out. Being late on all your assignments is not a good model for future employment. Being rude or talking over other people, I mean, these are things that don't work in any workplace. And so that's the kind of direction or steering I've been doing over the years. But no, I don't think I've ever said that straight out. Have you?
Yeah.
You have? What happened?
No, I mean, you know, you can do it in a kindly way. You can say, you know, this isn't for you. And there will be people who say you shouldn't do that because some people who could have been counted out, who you might have counted out, might turn out to do extremely well. But I don't do it every day. I haven't done it that much. But every once in a while, you want to help somebody sort of find the right place. You taught at the Columbia Journalism School, which is the best and the brightest, right?
Yeah, I did. And so, I don't know. I guess I didn't say that to any of those students.
No.
No, but I mean, you know, I could have. I mean, there are probably people who are good or bright, but they might not necessarily have the diligence. I think that's part of it, or the stick-to-it-ness, because they're, again, the traditional pathways have closed some of them, and so they'd have to really be entrepreneurial and create their own possibilities in a different kind of way than they would when I went to the J school in the late 90s, and you know, you could just go get a job, right? But some of these students can't, and you're going to have to be pretty aggressive and maybe in certain ways do what I've done or you remarked on, like do all these different things, because doing one thing just doesn't work anymore.
So contemporarily, right now, we are seeing a rash of stories as we speak about the University of Virginia, Rolling Stone, whether or not the ethics of journalism are what they once were or never were, I don't know. And Rolling Stone, it looks like, are being sued for this false, or what appears to be a false story about rape. And the journalism profession has been rocked by this. What do you make of it?
I think the Rolling Stone story was a breakdown of chain of command or something. There's so many different parts that didn't work, right? And so it's hard to find just one culprit. I think there is a kind of a misplaced desire to be sensitive, you know, that obviously blew up, that maybe the editors weren't totally sure of how to deal with sources who were requesting anonymity for this particular reason, right? I mean, the one thing I think is more system-wide is the desire for really sensational stories. So there's lots of rape stories out there. I wrote one about Title IX, and those women were sexually assaulted. There's no question. Sometimes it was documented, right? But those stories are maybe not as exciting. You know, there's no broken glass table. There's no gang, anything. It was just an assault in a college campus. So I think the one thing that we can do to check ourselves is, why do we have to tell the most extreme story? You know, can we tell a story that is sort of the more ordinarily unhappy story?
Well, you know why, right? You know, that's what people want. It's the front page of the Post or the News, or, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, there's lots of people who do want to also feel something, and not just feel an extreme feeling, but feel an identification or feel like, oh, that is like my experience, you know. And in a way, by just representing people in very extreme straits, it's not always doing us a service to the issue or to the truth, right? This is what we've discovered. But I mean, one of the things I think at EHRP that I'm looking for is really deep stories that you can identify with about economic insecurity and poverty, but they don't have to be the most extreme of the extreme. In fact, I'm sort of interested, you know, I wrote a story like this about an adjunct who couldn't make ends meet and was on food stamps, and she had a disabled kid and her life's really hard. She deserved far better. And I called her part of the hyper-educated poor. But she's not homeless, you know? She's a really bright, struggling person. I mean, her life's rough, and it was rough enough for it to be an interesting and important story, but it's not on the edge of the world. You know what I'm saying? So I think that I would love to see more stories that are kind of like that.
And why do you think that doesn't happen? I mean, to me, it's an economic model. These folks think that, you know, you blow it up, you make it the most you can, you horrify people, and they'll read it. Not if it's the Alyssa brand of journalism, which I admire, but I don't know that it sells.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it sells. I mean, I hope it does. You know, I mean, I work with Barbara Ehrenreich, and, you know, Sure. She wrote a book about ordinary retail work and service work, and these were ordinarily horrible stories. These were stories of people who, you know, had their stuff checked by their bosses on, you know, the restaurant floor, that went through their bags, and, you know, who couldn't take any breaks during the day and things like that. And that's millions of people in America, really. And yet it's pretty horrifying when you read about it, and millions of people seem to want to read about it. So I feel like maybe we should be a little more confident in our audiences.
Mm. Well, there's no question. Look, I'm married to a woman who is a real intellectual. She reads all of the book reviews and all of the major, you know, things that are of interest to you, I'm sure. Nevertheless, I don't think she's representative of everybody.
I guess not, but you can see some of the potential risks of going for the most extreme story.
I'm not arguing for it, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that's sort of the way it is. Rupert Murdoch knows what he's doing with the New York Post. And while I despise it, I don't know the way around it.
You know, it's funny. Somebody was showing me, you know, the numbers, how many people were, the site's going to remain nameless, but it was a popular news website. And what were the numbers of social justice stories? Which social justice stories had the most readers, right? They could measure this. They had metrics. And it was often the best told stories. And it was often the stories with the most compelling headlines. And they were often compelling to the reader. They're like 10 things that your boss could be doing to exploit you, you know? And I mean, you could say that's sensationalist, but it's actually pretty useful service journalism for a lot of readers. Mm. And I found that enlightening, and I wanted to share it with my students because I was like, look, this is also, if you sort of wrap some of these serious narratives with a title that's really intense, sometimes that does some of the work for you and people will read the work.
We're talking to Alyssa Quart, author, multimedia narrative journalist, and this year's James H. Ottaway Senior Visiting Professor of Journalism. So I guess I want to know this. What do you make your students do?
Well, we have written op-eds. We're working on a feature. I try to teach some supplemental multimedia elements, and I'm bringing in a photographer and a filmmaker in the next couple of weeks to give additional kind of backup because I'm not really the technician here. I'm the person sort of sometimes pulling some of these projects together as a producer. So I'm teaching them that, but I also hope I'm sort of teaching them quality writing. I've been assigning, you know, New Jack by Ted Conover. I've assigned Nickel and Dimed, you know, portions of that. We've been watching, you know, some documentary footage and multimedia and doing, you know, in-class exercises where we try to write good anecdotal leads and that kind of thing, interviewing each other. So, yeah, I mean, I'm hoping I'm teaching sort of fundamentals with a digital age twist. That's kind of what I'm hoping to do, fundamentals of narrative nonfiction.
How do you find the students? Are they lazy? Are they smart? Are they aggressive?
Oh, these students are really lovely. They're working hard, most of them, and I mean, some of them are, you know who you are. But no, I'm joking. I think they're all working really hard, and they're just earnest, and they seem to want to learn, and they seem open to ideas and open to becoming better. And so I'm happy to have met some of them.
Well, you know, I've been running this Legislative Gazette project, which brings us, you know, New Paltz students and others to Albany for their senior year, and they cover the legislature and the rest of it. I have found, for whatever it's worth, that the most academically brilliant are not the ones who necessarily make it, you know, in the trade. I think it comes down to fire in the belly and screw the consequences. That's a question.
Well, that was what I was kind of saying to you about what I tell students who are not totally there, and I'm, you know, it's a lot of it is about diligence. It's sticking to it. It's having your stories killed. It's having people not return your emails or your calls, both as a reporter, you know, calling sources, and, you know, as someone trying to get an editor's attention, right? So it's the most, like, kind of obsessive students, I think, that are going to make it. They just have to decide this is what they want. And, you know, if they can't get the person to talk to them, they're going to go to their house, or they're going to wait for them, you know, at their job, or whatever. They're going to email them a lot. And, you know, these are the kinds of things that you can try to say it over and over again. But if somebody doesn't have that, I guess, intensity and bravery, sort of, there's an element, or, you know, I don't know who, what aggression, it's just not going to work.
Do you ever point to the bad ones? What I mean is, look, there's some very bad people out there in journalism. And, you know, it's not easy to call them out. So I'm wondering whether, you know, it's a responsibility of a professor to say, now look at this guy and what he does. He never has a source. He never does this. He never does that. You know, how do we know he's not making it up? Do you ever do that kind of thing?
I've done it before. And actually, just talking to you, I'm thinking maybe I should assign the UVA story and have them see, you know, what they would have done differently.
Well, now everybody knows what they would have done differently.
Yeah, now it's not whatever. It's not really a much of an exercise. I mean, I've definitely shown multimedia, and I've been like, this is very good, and this is considered an industry standard. But what would make this less just bells and whistles and more of a substantial work of journalism? So that's, to me, if I'm showing, you know, integrated multimedia, and that's my worry with multimedia sometimes, it doesn't have social justice themes, or it's not necessarily newsworthy. So, you know, what are ways that we can try to come up with, you know, multimedia ideas that have that kind of sobriety to them, really, you know, and aren't just, you know, kind of, you know, amazing to look at.
Well, Alyssa Quart, can you give us, those of us who are not as familiar with multimedia as we should be, what a good example of a multimedia effort has been recently?
Well, the one I really liked was called Gun Country, and that was in the Times, I don't know, maybe a year ago, year and a half ago, and it was a look at gun control, really, through, I forget how many characters, like 6 or 7 people who'd experienced being shot, experienced being sharpshooters, experienced you know, having a kind of transformation from being a gun enthusiast to, you know, not knowing what they think about gun possession. So I think that was great because that was lots of photos by this really amazing photographer, Todd Heisler, and then great audio, really crisp and really well executed, running alongside these stories. And I felt like by the end of it, you really feel like you understand a lot about why people love guns and why they don't.
But Alyssa, now I don't want to be seen as being inappropriate here, but so what? I mean, you know, how many people are there enough people being influenced by this sort of insider, intellectual, all of which is great work? But I mean, to what degree is that going to account for the social change which you're clearly after?
Well, I mean, a lot of the multimedia, like for instance on the Times site, gets a lot of eyeballs. I mean, yeah, admittedly, it's often the more, you know, thrilling multimedia like Snowfall, but that had, I don't remember, millions and millions of clicks within the first week, and it got like a Peabody and a Pulitzer, and it was probably one of the most looked at pieces that year, I think. So, I mean, you know, people aren't, they're engaging with this material, especially if it's photography. I mean, they're engaging with it more than the written word. So I don't know. I think if you're going to try to make a social justice project, you should probably make it with images because then people are going to feel it more.
Aren't you better off taking something like the Tsarnaev brothers and the Boston bombing and, you know, extrapolating from that what social implications these things have? So in other words, instead of working inductively from the very beginning and saying, okay, we're going to study from the bottom on up and we're going to show you people who have guns, people who suffer from guns, and not have the kind of exposure that you might, why not take something like the Boston, you know, marathon bombers and showing what access to lethal weapons might be and capturing more people that way?
Well, again, you're going to the extreme, the extreme end of this, which, you know, again, I'll have to say I kind of question because that's not most of the people who possess guns, right, or misuse them even.
Right.
But let's say you do choose to do it about them. There's lots of room for that. And I think there's great multimedia possibilities around, you know, around terrorist activity, around surveillance. I mean, one of the best projects recently was NSA Decoded from The Guardian that was about Snowden, and I think that was pretty popular, too. So it's not just highbrow, you know?
Yeah. Does Snowden, in your opinion, Alyssa, does Snowden get a fair break from American journalists just because he went so far over the line to expose all this country's secrets? Now, I'm a big admirer because I think you can't have a democracy unless you have fact. But I'm also thinking that, you know, to some degree, this country will not tolerate that sort of exposure. I ask you that in your role as the James H. Ottaway Senior Professor, because
the country will not tolerate that kind of exposure.
Yeah, in other words, you won't read things in Pravda in Russia, and you won't read things in our press that do justice to somebody's effort. I happen to think Snowden's an excellent example of that. I mean, Snowden's a hero to a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say he's a hero to me, but what he did was amazing and important. I don't really understand what you're asking me. Exactly.
No, I've switched subjects, and I'm asking you whether or not the press is controlled by the societal, political class in this country that won't let us really play things fairly. I mean, you're the professor. You're teaching the kids. I'm asking you that question because I want to know, to what degree is this propaganda? To which degree is there political control of the press?
There may be some political control, but you can also see, you know, Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, et cetera,
sure,
you know, winning every journalistic prize, getting cover of Washington Post, you know, the Academy Awards. So it's not like major institutions haven't signed off on not only the original Snowden expressions, but also, you know, later representations of them, right, by the very people who enabled Snowden to, you know, make his message known and these files out. So, I mean, I think, you know, I don't know. I don't feel like it's entirely been rigged against people trying to tell the truth about this country. I mean, I also think there is kind of a class struggle of sorts going on with people who are, you know, so-called leakers, where the less well-placed leakers or people who expose classified materials get punished with greater and longer prison sentences than your, you know, Petraeus or that kind of person. So I think that's something you're seeing a lot of, right? Or the Chelsea Mannings, you know, locked up for 35 years and, you know, generals getting a slap on the wrist and probably like a nice professorship somewhere. So I think there's a lot of, it's a continuum of what happens when people share materials they're not supposed to.
You work in poetry. How important is poetry in this country right now? I'm always shocked when so many people tell me how much they admire poets because, you know, I don't read poetry. I'm wondering whether I'm extrapolating to other people that this is a medium that is really important in this country.
Well, you know, this is Poetry Month. April's Poetry Month. And my joke is, you know, this is the single month that Americans must deal with the form that they avoid the most. So people use poetry for important occasions, but then they sort of hide it away like silverware that they can't put in a dishwasher. You know, reviewers don't review it that much. It's seen as kind of this priestly art. I'm interested in, probably predictably, given that I'm editor of Economic Hardship Reporting Project, something I call civic poetry or poetry about capital. You know, as I was saying, it's also about journalism. And so I see something like, you know, the Claudia Rankine doing a book like Citizen, which is an amazing book about race in America. And that just won all the, you know, run many major national book prizes and has been, I think, selling relatively briskly. And so, I mean, there are spaces where people are trying to write poetry that engages with, you know, politics and inequality and getting some at least critical success. You know, I don't know in terms of sales, but and that's what I was interested in doing with Monetized, also addressing inequality in a poetic form.
What's the advantage in doing it that way? In other words, what can you do in poetry that you can't do in, you know, writing a good book, prose?
You know, Monetized, I was writing it for many years. It's probably like 15 years or something off and on. And
that is, for those who are joining us late, your new book of poetry.
My new book of poetry. And I would be on a reporting trip and I'd have some sort of reaction to something that I couldn't put in the article. It just wasn't fit. It didn't fit. It wasn't journalistic. And it was sort of the supplement to an article I'd be writing, or, you know, if I went to do a travel piece or just went on vacation, I'd see something, or went to a book fair, you know, in Florida, I'd see something that was very striking to me, and then I'd write a poem about it because, again, it didn't fit in with my journalistic work. So that's what generated most of the poems. They're sort of all, like, on the side of journalism. And one of my friends joked that it's, like, basically my journalism with 95% of the words missing. So that's the effect.
So help me, and I'm not trying to be cruel here. I'm just asking, what is it about poetry with 95% of the words missing that is so impressive or that is so important?
I feel like poetry can say things. I mean, indeed, people use it for important occasions, right? They use it for births and weddings and funerals. Mm. Why? Because especially if you're not a believer, you're not part of a church, you sort of need to find a language or a rhetoric to talk about really important things. And a lot of public language, you know, look at CNN, look at presidential speeches, it's sort of been drained of its rhetorical power, right? So I think what poetry, when it's good, and I'm talking again about the civic poetry can do, is it can kind of speak to the occasion of our contemporary political landscape or our personal lives as well, in a way that other kinds of language kind of can't, and in which, you know, Monetized is an ironic title because poetry is the least monetary language out there, right? You make nothing writing it. And so I was sort of interested in what that difference is, you know, because what happens when you write in a language that nobody's paying you for by the word, right? And there's no controls in that way. It's not, there's no house style to meet, right? And I think there can be kind of like feelings and thoughts and critical thoughts expressed in a different kind of way than you could in a traditional, you know, essay or something.
I have a very good friend from my childhood, from growing up on Fire Island, who, you know, just wrote a book of poems about, you know, memories of Fire Island. I thought it was great. Nevertheless, you know, when you say that you can't get the same message out in prose as you can in poetry, I'm fascinated by that.
I didn't say that. Okay. I mean, you can get the same message out. There's emotional responses to... Should I read one?
Do you want to hear one? Absolutely, sure.
Okay, so this is one that's sort of about the end of the 1960s and journalism as well. Okay,
great.
It's called Downloaded. My autofill always writes, Dear Mom and Dad, we are DVDs, cassettes, LPs, even Betamax. Grandfather was offset type, announcing the death of Ferdinand. And these kids content managed, networked, of their own devices. For them, let's download lit about child murderers, that is, children who murder, while the elders recount the activism age as if telling Norse sagas. It seems the 60s were good for the people in them, a dream of a better world helping the dreamers more than the dreamed of. I am only trying to make sense of what came later.
That's great. The death of Ferdinand, the references to...
Yeah.
References
oh,
to
Franz Ferdinand.
Franz
you know,
Ferdinand. Sure.
That's what, exactly how we began the hour, talking about forms that are becoming defunct and, you know, memories of our older relatives being imparted to us and, you know, some of the disconnects from the 60s and now. So that's kind of the tone of a lot of the book.
But how much do people project into what they don't understand? I say that because you said Ferdinand, and the first thing that came to my mind was Ferdinand the Bull.
I love that, but so, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with you having seeing this other kind of space opening up. I'm cool with that. I mean, you see something, it's you'll never think about Ferdinand for the next year, and now you've seen Ferdinand. I'm okay with that.
Yeah. And the other Ferdinand, while a very important story, is obscure to many people. So you don't get to explain it in the poetry. Either you get it or you don't.
What's funny, somebody asked me to kind of anatomize one of my poems for a magazine. And so I'm trying to do that. And that's been an interesting, like, how is this actually media criticism? Because, I mean, a lot of it is kind of about media. So I can, I mean, do you want me to read another?
Yes, absolutely.
Channeling. Overnight, binging turned positive. Why does this water taste chemical? A new filter is always needed. We toss Mizuna. You tell me authors of the past believed in the devil. Is it so wrong to have diabolical nostalgia when that author is all over speaker videos, handless mics, gel lights, 17,000 likes? Remember the unheard, dialect indeterminate, a man hammering cans into doors, a woman trading little for little in a truly local market. Let's pan, then cut between these stories. To avoid criticism, we'll use different theme songs. Those women at the spa have launched a search for a holy leader, but we have none over here, only channels.
You know, that's so great. I love the 17,000 likes. Because
you know, I realized that after this got published, I was like, it's more like 879,000. Like a young person reading this would be like, so 17,000 likes? But yeah, I was trying to get, actually, it was inspired after I went to Kripalu and I saw the women.
Kripalu, for those who are listening, is probably the greatest yoga place in the United States. But go ahead. Yeah,
and it's in the Berkshires. Yeah, and yeah. I saw people looking, wanting, questing spiritually. And I was thinking, oh, dear, you know, people are trying to channel something spiritual, but all we have is these digital channels and these cable channels. That's the channels that are really there for these people who are on their quests now. It's hard to, there's no holy leaders for them. So that's sort of what it's about. And actually, when I said that authors of the past believed in the devil, I was talking about a fight that Nathaniel Hawthorne and Melville had on a mountain in the Berkshires where they were discussing the devil. And I was thinking, what writers today talk about things like the devil? They're talking really, they're worrying about their speaker series and their TED Talks. They're not arguing about the spirit, you know. So I just, this book is very clearly about the media industry in that way.
It's so great because my kids have insisted that we go on Facebook, which we are on. And then you begin to measure how important you are by how many likes you get. So if you put a picture of your grandson on, and you get 109, likes, you say, boy, that's great, 109 likes for the kid. That's wonderful. I'm successful at offering this photograph. But if you get 3, then you're not worth anything.
It's true. So how many followers do you have?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
You're not following your followers.
I don't do that. We have a lot here at WMC. I know that.
But I'm sure.
But I don't look and see that. However, my son, who is in New Orleans, when I say something, I wrote a column the other day about Cuomo and teachers and how terrible he was being towards teachers in New York State. And it got tweeted around the damned world. I mean, I never saw anything like it. People were just tweeting it like crazy. And my son wrote me and said, boy, you know, basically, are you successful? So your poem.
Is this part of the critique of Cuomo around the Common Core?
It's part of it. But it's basically that there are teachers who believe that the governor has climbed on their shoulders in order to get more popular himself and is dissing them. And so basically, I find that horrendous. I've written about it a number of times. And it turns out that very few people have been putting it out there publicly, whether they are afraid of this governor, which if you read the new biography by Michael Schneerson, you get the idea that maybe they should be. You know, you get the idea that public criticism of powerful Machiavellian figures is not the easiest thing in the world, which may be why I was asking you before about whether, you know, there's social political control over what the depth of our societal critiques can be.
Well, I think there is. I mean, I think there's a marketplace control, too. I mean, this is part of the problem. You know, you were just saying about extreme stories being more popular, and I also think certain kinds of stories that might be more critical of people in power are seen as less saleable. I mean, there's a combination of, you know, politics and, you know, financial concerns that sometimes flow through these things. So, you know, and that's why you wind up having more gentle coverage of some figures than you should and harsher coverage of others, right?
Well, yes, that is right. And, you know, what's so interesting to me, and I know to you as a journalist, is how this progresses. You get a guy, he's got the Cuomo name, he does extraordinarily well in an election. He gets 63% of the vote the first time he runs. He gets less the next time. And the journalists, I hate to say it this way, but like yapping dogs, start to get a little bit more courage when they should have been there in the first place.
Right. Well, part of it was what Cuomo did after he got office, right, that sort of incited people, no?
Well, it depends. I mean, yes, he did some wonderful things in terms of, you know, gay marriage, for example, or
like the equal amendment for, you know, better balance kind of stuff. Yeah.
Or guns, which was very gutsy, and I wrote about that. But then also he did some things that were really reprehensible. And then finally, people came out of their dens and started to take notice of that. So the question as a professor of journalism, Alyssa Quart, is this, and that is, do the journalists you're looking at have the kind of guts they ought to have as a profession?
I think there are a lot of very brave journalists still. I mean, I know a number of them. I'm married to one of them. You know, I think that there are people out there who are still telling the truth, and now they're also doing it with less, you know, institutional support. Sometimes they're doing it freelance or without, you know, a legal team that can support them, you know. But you look at the James Risens and there's a lot of amazing work out there. And now there is this kind of new kind of visual journalism that's going to places that they haven't been before. And, you know, I feel like there's been great work also around reproductive rights, which is the area, because that was what the film I produced, mm-hmm. The Last Clinic, was on. So, I'm doing another project around that. And I feel like people are really showing a lot of bravery with that. They're filming in clinics. They're telling these stories. They're telling stories about the ways that local legislators are trying to, you know, shut down clinics around the country. So I don't think it's gone. I don't think bravery's gone.
Do you have one more poem you could share with us?
Sure. What kind of theme are you looking for, Alan? You know, do you want journalism? Do you want
journalism.
One that's more monetary? Give you journalism?
Give me journalism.
Okay, let me look. I'm trying to make sure that they're not too obscure because I know that that's not going to go over so well. Okay, so here is a poem about gossip journalism.
Ooh, cool.
It's called TMZ, named after the site, the gossip site. Another dead teen star, fluorescent flowers wrapped in paper. Figures of urban scandal, sundry disappointees, a son's suicide by leash, songbird's questionable incisors, gender, lupine. She's putting phony back into phonetic. We've invented osteoporotic abbreviations. We've forgotten calm, masterful time. A star imports craggy rocks for his driveway, completes his stalking soundtrack. His girlfriend rocks a hobo bag, not person. No better fiction this year.
That's great. You can't have journalism without it being a reflection on the audience, the potential audience it has, right? I mean, the whole idea of TMZ, the whole idea of Page Six, the whole idea of all of that stuff is that this is a reflection on what people want. And instead of our being angry at who gives it what they want, one would be better to critique the society.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was pregnant and I was reading these sites because I was in bed. I was on bed rest, some kind of bed rest. And I was like, wow, these sites are fascinatingly horrible. And what they're doing to our minds, these star celebrity gossip sites. So, you know, that's where I came up with some of these phrases because I just was, some of them were literally based on the phrases in the articles, you know, a star imports craggy rocks for his driveway, you know, the stalking soundtrack is a joke, but just this endless tabloidal rush, like you're talking about the tabloids, Rupert Murdoch, but it's gotten so much worse. There's just, you know, every single site, E! Online and TMZ and, you know, there's so many. I can't even recite all their names. And they're just everywhere. And yeah, indeed, they're the most popular. So I was sort of fascinated by them.
You're a woman. Sexism is prevalent in our society. We know that. The sexploitation of women in the tabs, you know, millions of people reading these things. Every edition has at least one semi-nude woman in them. And it seems to work. You're the journalism professor. What's that about?
Oh, I mean, it's like a long history of objectification of women and the,
sure,
you know, the male gaze and exploitation. And I just think, I do think the lack of controls online has sort of created even more intense environment. You know, people have called it pornified, but I think that's part of it, right? There's greater expectations of, you know, women playing a sexualized part in public than there were in the past, I think. And that's I think it's really hard for young women. And I think that some of the, you know, pushback of some of the so-called rape culture on campus and, you know, some of the concerns around sexual assault are reflecting how women are being or feeling like they're being exploited and indeed being assaulted. And, you know, I don't mean the actual victims of assault, but I mean the people who are intensely, you know, championing them on campus. You know, I think it's an environment where there's a lot of sexism. So that's interesting to me as a journalist. It's something I wrote one piece about. I may wind up writing more about at some point. But
so on the one hand, we have feminists, really good, wonderful people who have intellectually been pursuing all of this stuff. And on the other, we have this thing, it's okay to have gigantic billboards or this model who was with Harvey Weinstein, and then they show a huge picture of her, which is as close to pornography as anything I've ever seen in a newspaper. And you wonder how these two things jibe, the feminists and the sexploitation. And I only have a minute to give you on that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think to me, of course, as the editor of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, the even deeper problem is sexism in the workplace and the ways in which, and I've written about this, women, and this is my new book, it's actually on this, women struggle from the motherhood penalty where they're hired in far fewer numbers when they have children and, you know, they don't have maternal leave and, you know, I mean, women in general are hired less, but they're paid less. They're paid, offered 11,000 less in starting salaries than non-mothers, but that is mothers, and they're 44% less likely to be hired than non-mothers for the same job. And so I think, I mean, to me, that's fine. So it's sexualized imagery, but where the rubber hits the road is money and the workplace, and that's where you see institutional sexism at work.
Well, I have to tell you, Professor Alyssa Quart, author, Multimedia Narrative Journalism, and this year's James H. Ottaway Senior Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz. This has been delightful for me, and I know you have really reached to put it on the table, and I'm very, very appreciative of that. And we've been out of time. We're talking to Alyssa Quart, author and multimedia narrative journalist, and this year's James H. Ottaway Senior Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz. Professor, thanks so much for joining us. I hope to meet up with you in the Berkshires.
Thank you, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org. Thank you.